Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. The downtown shooting at the Stevens Institute this week put focus, once again, on violence and mental illness, as does the Obama administration's emphasis on it in the latest gun control recommendations. Before that, of course, Sandy Hook, Aurora, and Tucson. Fact is, assessment and treatment for mental illness or lack of it seems to be a key component in many of our mass shootings. Often it takes incarceration for many of those who are mentally ill to get treatment, but that can be too late for them or their victims. I'm Don Marsh. That's what we're talking about on today's program. With me in studio, Dr. Fred Rotnick, Associate Professor in the Department of Family and Community Medicine at St. Louis University and Medical Director for Corrections Medicine in the St. Louis County Department of Health. In a recent piece he wrote for the St. Louis Beacon, he said, incarceration should not be used as therapeutic intervention and jails and prisons should not be our safety nets. Jackie Lukich is Director of Advocacy for NAMI St. Louis. NAMI is the acronym for National Alliance on Mental Illness. And joining us by phone from San Diego is Dr. Michael Mancini, mental health expert, associate professor in the School of Social Work in the College of Public Health and Social Justice at St. Louis University. Thank you all so much for being with us today. A very timely program indeed. Let me begin with you, Dr. Rotnick. The first line of your Beacon article reads, and I'm quoting here, "We already have a safety net mental health care system in the United States. It's called incarceration." Elaborate on that, if you would.
Certainly. Since about 1976, the U.S. Supreme Court has interpreted the Eighth Amendment to the Constitution, that which we're familiar with about cruel and unusual punishment for inmates, to mean that anyone incarcerated in the United States has a constitutional right to health care. That was expanded in 1980 to more explicitly include mental health care. And the consequences of that, the chief consequence of that, is that the incarcerated population in the United States is the only part of the population that has a guaranteed right to health care.
Jackie, your take on that, I know you are a boots-on-the-ground person. That has to be very disturbing to you.
Oh, absolutely. We absolutely don't like the fact that, you know, people have to go to jail to get mental health care. But that seems to be how it's played out for us in the United States and in the state of Missouri. We do need to change that. And I'm hoping that this article by Dr. Rotnick and other articles that have come out in the paper, you know, will help us do that in Missouri. We must make mental health care a priority. We have to change the system's focus from crisis care to early identification and treatment with effective programs. We have effective programs. We're not funding those programs. And those programs are what's going to help people, you know, stay out of jail.
Dr. Mancini, is that it? Is it basically just an issue of funding?
I think it's a multi-pronged issue. We certainly have a gap in practice. What we're also lacking is good quality long-term treatment. So while we have a beds and meds issue, which are important tools, we have a bigger gap in effective long-term care in the community. And I think that we know what works, but we're lacking the level of support funding-wise, but we're also lacking, I think, behavioral health experts and counselors as well to provide those services.
You know, one of the things that has been talked about a lot, and Dr. Rotnick, you certainly have alluded to this in your article, and that is another article that was written by a woman, Liza Long. The title of that article was "I Am Adam Lanza's Mother." Adam Lanza, of course, is the shooter in Newtown, Connecticut. And basically what she was saying was the fact that she has a son who's got a problem, and she was told the best way to get help for him is to have him arrested.
Right. That's what really prompted me to write my piece, was that she had a 13-year-old son who was violent and yet to have a firm diagnosis or treatment plan. And she talked about the difficulties of accessing care for her son and how she felt isolated and somewhat helpless in finding something other than inpatient hospitalization. when she mentioned that her son's caseworker suggested that he somehow commit a crime to get a paper trail so that he could access care and access case management, I thought that was a perfect time to bring up the fact that in Missouri, one of the things we do well is work with adolescents who are in trouble with the law. And as Jackie mentioned, there are programs at work. The problem is the safety net is supposed to be a safety net. It's what acrobats have so they don't hit the ground. We need to be working with people so they don't even have to worry about hitting the ground.
Jackie, how did we get here?
Well, you know, I think it's a matter of people understanding mental health. We tend to stigmatize it instead of embracing it as a disease that needs to be addressed, which it is. And, you know, we need to get more educational programs out there to people so that they understand it. Because we do need the political will to fund these programs in the community. And that's what we don't have.
Dr. Mancini, it seems that every time we have an incident such as those we've had recently, mental illness is associated with it one way or another, and I'm guessing that in some cases mental illness may not be involved. But when this does happen, doesn't that further stigmatize the whole issue of mental illness and dealing with it?
I think that absolutely when these kinds of events happen, that people with mental illnesses sustain a bigger burden because they're stigmatized. And we know that the vast majority of people with mental illness are not violent. They're no more violent than people without people with mental illnesses are no more violent than people without mental illnesses. But, you know, the media and the press don't really demonstrate that. So I think that there is an added burden that when these kinds of things happen, we have a knee-jerk reaction to restrict rights for people with psychiatric disabilities, to take away their guns and to take away their voting. And certainly, looking at everyone in terms of gun control and making sure that people who are dangerous don't have guns is very important. But I think that they do have to take on that burden of stigma every time one of these things happens.
Dr. Roddick, you want to comment on that part of it?
Yes, I was going to say that as I've mentioned in talking to some student groups as well lately, people with mental illnesses right now could easily become a scapegoat. And I think we're creating a false sense of security in our country. If people are under the impression that if we throw so many million dollars at a mental health program, we'll never have another Sandy Hook episode. Those are apples and oranges. And I think it's very important that some advocacy groups, such as the NRA, doesn't say this is a mental health problem, so let's just address mental health issues. That's further stigmatizing and simplifying a very complicated situation.
It should be pointed out here, I have in my notes, that I think it was actually raised during comments by President Obama yesterday with regard to gun control, that the mentally ill are more likely to be victims of crime, of violent crime, than to be perpetrators of it. Any thoughts about the recommendations that the president had yesterday? I'll start with you, Dr. Mancini. I'm sure you've had some exposure to that over the last 12, 24 hours. What do you see in his proposals specifically related to the mentally ill that caught your attention?
Well, I think that it's important looking at proposals that expand, again, long-term rehabilitative treatment towards people with mental illness. We certainly need to expand screening and early intervention efforts. There's no doubt about that. We certainly need some availability for crisis beds for acute situations. But what happens next is the big issue. So it's very important to develop programming around using systems of care approaches for children and adolescents who have psychiatric issues. It's certainly important to have more programs like assertive community treatment, peer support, supported housing, and these other evidence-based practices. And so I think throwing money at the problem is important, but I think where that money goes is even more important, to make sure that it goes to targeted evidence-based programs that work. And also, we have these programs, and we know that they work, but we also know that the vast majority of people with mental illness are not receiving those programs. And so in addition to increasing programs, we need to make sure that we're training practitioners and training students in the way that best will increase the availability of those programs so that they are actually practicing them in the community. And I think that multi-pronged approach is important.
Jackie, what's your take on it?
I concur with what Dr. Mancini said. And something that the president said yesterday really stuck out in my mind. He said that we need to make access to mental health care as easy as access to guns. And it stuck out because, there are so many instances when people need access to care. And when you need access to mental health care, you need it now. You don't need it, down the road 3 months. And so if you're contacting a community mental health center and you don't have Medicaid, you may be out of luck if they don't have a grant that they can use to provide care for you. So I think that there is a capacity issue there that needs to be talked out about, too. There's a local group called the Behavioral Health Network of Greater St. Louis, which was created in response to the closure of MPC and through the health regional health commission in the city of St. Louis. And that group got some money through the closure of MPC to actually help people who are being discharged from the hospital connect with community mental health care in the community. And what we have found is that there are more people that need those services than we can handle. And that when we do connect people, we see a lot of good outcomes, such as decreased cost to Medicaid and increased outcomes to people. So in addition to evidence-based services, which I totally concur on, I think we do need to increase capacity. I've been working with the St. Louis Mental Health Board in the city to try to increase the ability of people, of providers, to provide these programs through trainings through a federal grant. And we also have been working on supportive housing. It's interesting. There's also an analogy I'd like to make with the jails in terms of housing. I think they're also our largest providers of housing for people with mental illness, in addition to nursing homes. And we need to change this. Supportive housing is a great model, and we have found out in the city of St. Louis that through a report that the Corporation for Supportive Housing did, that we need 782 new units to support people with mental illness and or substance abuse disorders. So we're out there trying to create that. And, the legislature can help us with that, with trying to keep those low-income housing tax credits in place.
Dr. Rodnick.
Yes, I'm not a big numbers guy, but some of the numbers that help frame your comments a little bit, Jackie, is that at the height of U.S. mental hospital census back in 1955, the number of people who were in a hospital dedicated to mental health services was 560,000 people in the U.S. In 2005, that number dropped to 80,000, a seventh of what it once was. Many of those people are homeless. Many of those people are incarcerated because when we started doing the deinstitutionalization, which went on for the next few decades, the handoff to the community-based programs, halfway houses, didn't happen. And then the other issue related to housing is that the three largest jails in the United States, Rikers Island in New York, Cook County in Chicago, and then the LA County Jail, all of those jails have more folks with diagnosed mental illness than the largest mental health hospital in the United States.
I have to take a break, but the number I have here is the rate of inmate mental illness in this country is five times that of the general public.
Yes, and those numbers are from the Department of Justice, so they're not inflating.
And it's a startling figure, really making the point of what we're talking about today and why it's important to talk about it. We'll continue that conversation in just a moment. I have with me in studio Dr. Fred Rotnick of St. Louis
Louis University. Jackie Lukacs is with us. She's a director of advocacy for National Alliance on Mental Illness in St. Louis. And joining us by phone from San Diego, lovely San Diego, where he's fortunate to be attending a conference, is Dr. Michael Mancini. He's with the College of Public Health and Social Justice at St. Louis University. Back to continue our conversation in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation about mental health issues. And we're really relating those issues today to what is going on with regard to mental illness in the criminal justice system and the fact that we seem to be warehousing people with mental illness in our jails and prisons rather than giving them the treatment they need before it reaches that stage. My guests in studio include Fred Rotnick, Dr. Fred Rotnick of St. Louis University and Medical Director for Corrections Medicine at the St. Louis County Department of Health. Jackie Lukacs is Director of Advocacy for the National Alliance on Mental Illness in St. Louis. And joining us from San Diego is Dr. Michael Mancini with the College of Public Health and Social Justice at St. Louis University. I'd like to talk for a moment about the incident we had in downtown St. Louis a couple of days ago at the Stevens Institute. It's well known. Are you familiar with that incident? Because you're out of town, Dr. Mancini. I'm not sure you have details of what went on here. Does that ring a bell?
I am familiar with it, yes.
You are, okay. Well, as we know then, a shooter walked into the Institute and shot an administrator and shot himself. The man has been identified, the alleged shooter, I guess we have to say, as Sean Johnson. The thing that I find fascinating is the fact that this man has quite a track record. I mean, he was arrested some time ago, apparently tried to slice the neck of a taxi driver. He's had assault charges against him. And he's we've just learned today in the paper that he's been wanted in St. Louis County. The warrant's been out for a year. They haven't been able to track him down. Jackie, let me start with you with regard to someone like this. There are probably more like him out there than we'd care to count. I'm not quite sure how to phrase this, but here's a guy who has fallen through the cracks. He had big footprints, and yet he was able to acquire a gun somehow, shoot right. himself, and shoot the and shoot the right. administrator.
Well, I think you said it perfectly. He fell through the cracks, and I think this speaks to the fact that we do need to get, you know, fund more of those evidence-based services, and, you know, by the way, more mental health courts. Mental health courts have been shown to be effective in reducing recidivism and getting people into harder to serve people like him into care. But also, what would help, I think, a person like that is what Dr. Mancini mentioned earlier, is a sort of community treatment. One good thing that has developed lately is that the Department of Mental Health is supporting what they call a forensic assertive community treatment program that is run by Places for People. And their caseworkers, they go into the jails before they're discharged, and they identify people who have multiple arrests and struggle to get services in the community. And, you know, upon discharge, they work with them intensely to get them housing, to get them into services and on a program, and just help them live on a day-to-day basis. And assertive community treatment has, you know, been really effective in helping people, I think, like Mr. Johnson.
Yeah. Dr. Mancini, what should have happened to this guy? I mean, he was put on 5 years probation, I think it was, on this assault charge, and left out to go on his way. Under ideal circumstances, what should have happened to him when he was arrested on this charge of trying to slice the throat of a taxi driver?
Well, I think that if a mental illness was present, I think in an ideal world, an ideal situation, you would have had probation and parole working closely with mental health service providers to provide a coordinated system of care for this individual. It's not just a medication issue. Again, medications are very important. He was on medications. I believe his the rhetoric around it was when he was on his medications, he was a wonderful individual, and when he was off his medications, he was not. So we know that people with mental illness, for lots of reasons, fail to take their medication. So we need more than just medication to help reintegrate and help reintegrate this person back into society and to be a citizen. So just relying on medication is not appropriate for this particular individual. I think having that coordinated system of care, Jackie mentioned forensic assertive community treatment teams, very important evidence-based practice, but we have one or two of those teams in St. Louis. That's it. So we really, really have a behavioral workforce shortage issue, not just in St. Louis, but across the country. About 20% of the population in the country lives in the mental health professional shortage area. And that's an area that's been identified as having mental health professionals in a 6,000 to 1 ratio. So we have 20% of the population of this country living in that area, and about the same amount in Missouri living in a shortage area. So that's what should have happened, but given the low numbers of programming and professionals in the area, we unfortunately see people fall through the cracks quite frequently.
Dr. Rotnick, the fact that he was on medication makes this a mental health issue, or made it a mental health issue at that time, and yet he was simply let go. Your take on this and the ideal circumstance?
Well, I completely agree with Jackie and Mike in the sense that medications only do so much, and they only help from the point you start taking them. A lot of folks have their baseline of normal is very, very different from those of us who are highly functioning. Folks need wraparound services. The medication's a small part of it. It's the case management. It's the contact. It's the relationships that people need in order to be successful, to learn the right life habits, to learn how to be successful from everything from how to secure an apartment and pay rent, to paying a budget, to showing up at probation and parole. Keeping a calendar is very difficult for those of us with smartphones and help from other people. It's extremely difficult from people whose lives are maybe more chaotic for any number of reasons.
You know, what I was getting at, what I thought I might hear, is the fact that if it were was determined, and I'm the novice, you guys are the experts, the fact that he was on meds and he was given probation, that the answer might be, once this was determined, he should not have just simply been put on probation. He should have been put into a specific mental health program of some sort, Jackie,
right,
in which they could watch him, they could treat him, and they could deal with him. And you're saying there ain't no such animal.
Well, you know, like Dr. Mancini said, there's one or two forensic assertive community treatment programs here in St. Louis, and I don't think there are any other in the state of Missouri. So, you know, we have a long way to go here in Missouri to catch up to providing those services that are needed, the amount of services that are needed.
Where would we rank with other states? Is there any way to chart that?
Yeah, you know, the our national office, NAMI, had created a report that gave grades to each state, and we the last one was done in 2011, and we got a grade of a C. The Connecticut, interestingly enough, got a grade of a B. And the whole nation together got a grade of a D. So,
That tells us an awful lot. And Connecticut did better than average. Needless to say,
yeah, they did. And you know,
well, you know, did you want to say something? Go ahead, Doctor.
I was just going to mention that when we talk about the scarcity of services, one of the things that we're trying to do through the Regional Health Commission that I work with and the Behavioral Health Network, we're starting to try to look at hard dollars in terms of what is our current system costing us. About 3 or 4 years ago, we had a task force to look at folks who are high utilizers of mental health services. And we tried to identify people that we had access to de-identified data through the Department of Mental Health in Missouri. And we saw that the top utilizer generated charges of over $3 million from ED visits over the course of 1 year. You can fund a lot of programs with $3 million. And that's the reason why when we looked at opening Metropolitan Psychiatric Center with the changes there, we've recently opened the Psychiatric Stabilization Center in the same area on Del Mar. That's a joint venture with funding from the Regional Health Commission, from SSM, and from Barnes, because these hospitals as well, we're seeing what a tremendous financial burden people in mental health crises can create just in the emergency room. Because folks, it might sound callous, but folks with mental health crises tie up ER beds longer than many folks can. So for financial reasons in part, this unusual group of people came together to open the Psychiatric Stabilization Center. Until we can draw, I believe, business leaders into this, looking at healthcare expenditure, looking at how we're spending our money and realizing how suboptimal our current system is, I think that's when we're going to see more change.
Do you want to weigh in on that, Dr. Mancini?
Yeah, I believe I'm not. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe that report that Dr. Rotnett was referring to identified 3,700 people in Missouri that were so-called high utilizers of care. And I know that we're developing programs to do a lot of extensive outreach to identify those individuals and help incorporate them into community-based care. Because going to an emergency room is not the place that you want to go to get your main psychiatric care. You can wait long hours, sometimes up to 2 days. It may take weeks to get an appointment afterwards with a psychiatrist. So it's a very inefficient model of care when compared to community-based approaches. And when you look at the price tag of community-based approaches, like assertive community treatment teams, they are they can be expensive. But when you look at how much money they save over the long term, and the research clearly supports this, they save a tremendous amount of dollars and lives when they're applied appropriately.
Do we have any sense of how mental illness is affected by the Affordable Care Act, so-called Obamacare? Anybody have a sense of that, Jackie?
Well, yeah. I mean, I think the Affordable Care Act does address it in a major way. First of all, expanding Medicaid would greatly help that group of people, of particularly young men who are between the age of maybe 16 and 25, who may have the first onset of mental illness. And, you know, when you have your first onset, you struggle to accept it, you struggle to figure out what it is. And, you know, many of these people don't have parents who have insurance, so they're not still on their parents' insurance, but they also can't get Medicaid, you know. So, you know, the Affordable Care Act will help in that sense if Missouri chooses to pass that expansion. But it will also help under the newly health insurance exchanges that I guess the federal government now is going to come into the state of Missouri and create, because it requires what's called mental health parity for mental health and addictions. So,
well, that's going to be very exciting to you and to people in this field.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. Dr. Rotten?
And where we need to move towards that is, though it's an ongoing discussion as well, is getting away from this duality of physical health and mental health. That's going to take a long time to do. I think we're making steps that way. One of the most prominent things that people with quote-unquote good insurance have, you have your health insurance card, but a mental health problem, you flip it over and look at the number on the back. Those benefits are often managed separately. I think what we need to do is work towards system change, not only among healthcare professionals as we do at St. Louis U through our interprofessional education program, but we also need to work to integrate the provision of services towards a more integrated model so that people don't see, well, that's a mental health issue, so you need to see somebody else for that. We need to pull those together into more sophisticated teamwork for our patients and clients.
And your thoughts, Dr. Mancini?
I think we are moving towards integration. We've certainly moved towards integration of substance abuse and mental health services. Very important. And we're now talking about the integration of services, not only physical help, but also trauma, making services more trauma-informed. So I think these are wonderful evolutions in the program in mental health services. But one area of caution is we're expecting current mental health practitioners in the field to learn vast and complex skill sets. And so if we're going to expand these kinds of programs to be more integrated, we need to make sure that we're developing new practitioners and also helping current practitioners implement those practices effectively. Because right now, if you're just going to throw, you talk to any mental health practitioner, they are overwhelmed with the amount of work that they have in terms of paperwork, in terms of managing people, people's medications and lives and budgets and helping them in the, into their recovery. And to just throw more and more, more services on top and expect them to implement those services is going to overwhelm the current workforce. And so we need to have common sense approaches to helping people slowly integrate these skills so that they can practice them effectively.
I want to get the listening audience into this conversation at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org. We'll take a tweet at STL on air. You can also reach us through Facebook. Before I go to the phones, though, I'll need to take a break. We'll do that now and continue our conversation on mental health, particularly with regard to how it applies to our criminal justice system and what we're doing with people who are mentally ill within the criminal justice system, and also what we are not doing. Back in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again, and welcome back to our conversation on mental illness. I have with me in studio Jackie Lukic, Director of Advocacy for National Alliance on Mental Illness in St. Louis, Dr. Fred Rotnick of St. Louis University, Medical Director for Corrections Medicine in the St. Louis County Department of Health, and joining us by phone from San Diego is Dr. Michael Mancini with the College of Public Health and Social Justice at St. Louis University. Let's go to the phones and get a number of our listeners into this discussion. We'll begin with Ira, who is calling from North St. Louis. Ira, go ahead, please.
Yes. My question to the people on the board there, some years ago when Matt Blunt was governor of the state of Missouri, they kind of cut all those programs, you know, that, you know, put people on the street, you know, they were identifying kids at an early age and put them into the system. So right now, how can we go forward, okay, knowing we got a lot of people that were thrown out into the system, you know, without any help?
You know, one of the issues is we need to make sure we're offering a range of alternatives and a range of programs that people actually want. So it's important to do outreach, but it's also important to outreach to people and offer them programs that are effective, programs that help people get the things that they need and that they want, like housing and like getting back into school programs and education programs so they can reintegrate into society. And I think one of the issues with outreach is a lot of times there's people who get into the system and then drop out of the system because it doesn't have what they need. And maybe that was the case with the recent shooting in St. Louis. I don't know, and I really can't comment on that. But making sure that we outreach and provide a range of alternatives is really important.
I think that's something very important that legislators need to be aware of today, is we have to be very diligent about talking to the folks that mental health and gun violence most directly affects. And I can say that as somebody who lives in the city, but I've lived in the county where these problems are, some problems may not be as prominent. A lot of times we can have a somewhat paternalistic approach to public policy and public health measures. We need to make sure that we maintain a very vigorous dialogue with the people whose lives are most touched by these issues, as Mike mentions, because we can offer great programs, but if people are not going to avail themselves of services, nothing will come out of that. So it's a blend of what consumers and patients want and what evidence-based practices can provide good outcomes.
Jackie, yeah. I'm sure you deal with the legislature, I'm sure, from time
yes.
to time. I'm sure it's a big part, part of your job. What generally kind of a response do you get when you raise these issues in Jefferson City?
Well, you know, it's about having enough money to fund programs. And you know, generally, you know, we are getting kickback from supporting Medicaid expansion or anything related to the Affordable Care Act. So I think that we do need to do like what the president is doing and go to the people and create more will from the people for our services and programs and make them understand why this is happening and what is happening.
Well, this is where stigma comes in because people right. may be less inclined to get involved because
right.
there is this stigma.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, the mental health first aid educational program would be a great way to address that stigma and start our conversation.
There was an op-ed editorial in the Post-Dispatch today from Betty Sims on mental health first aid. And I had not heard the expression before. Who wants to tell me exactly what that is, Jackie, and why it's so important?
Well, you know, it's a program to teach the public, the general public, about mental illness, how to identify it, what are the signs, and most importantly, how to help someone access care. You know, this was created in Australia, by a woman who you know was thinking that you know when we have these first aid programs for primary you know issues, but we don't have anything for mental health. So she developed this program and has successfully, you know, taught many Australians about mental illness, how to identify it and how to help people. So I think it's a great program for everybody. And, you know, I think it needs to be implemented more broadly. The president has recommended that this be provided more broadly, particularly to teachers, school resource officers, and you know officers who carry guns in schools, and who are need to be more familiar with what mental illness is, and other adults that you know school age kids would come into contact with, and I think that's a good first step.
You know, this issue came up the other day. We did an interview with the new St. Louis police chief, Sam Dodson. We were talking about crisis intervention training. And, of course, the police, as first responders, they're the first one to come across people who are suspect.
Right.
I'd like to play a clip from that program in which the chief talked about this crisis intervention training.
We send our officers to CIT training, crisis intervention training, simply for that because there it takes a different style, a different technique to help arrest, to control, to understand those individual needs. And sometimes incarceration isn't the right answer, but you're right. That's the only way that they get the resources or they get the attention that they need. These CIT officers are trained to identify mental health issues and then help link those individuals to partners. St. Patrick's Center, alcohol rehabilitation programs, substance abuse programs, whatever it takes. And so we've invested a considerable amount of money and time in training our officers to be sensitive just to that issue.
Well, Dr. Mancini, that's a very important component to all of this, isn't it?
Absolutely. I think that a lot of cities have implemented CIT training for first responders. It's vital. I mean, it saves lives because if you don't know how to respond to somebody who's in crisis, a lot of times, there are unfortunate incidences of police officers having to shoot and kill people that otherwise wouldn't have to, and certainly violence going in the other direction towards police officers. So, being able to know how to intervene makes people, both officers and people that they're involved with, safer. And so, I think those programs are vital. They're low cost and they provide a tremendous benefit to the community.
And Dr. Rotnick, what it does is it takes these people who need treatment of some sort to a place where they can get it as opposed to putting them in a jail.
Exactly. once again, the jails are there for people who need to be there, but unfortunately without these resources, they become the only safe place where people can be seen, stabilized, and can be kept from themselves and others.
They're warehouses.
Exactly.
Yeah. Let's go back to the phones. We have, as I say, many people want to get into it. Let's bring in David. Go ahead, David. Come on in.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'd first like to say that Dr. Rotnick has greater vision and wisdom than anyone I've ever known in this field, and that goes back to my training as a family physician at the old Deaconess Hospital. So, Fred, this is Dr. Glick weighing in.
Thank you, David.
I work at a community health center in South St. Louis called Family Care Health Center. It's one of the federally qualified health centers in this region, and as these types of health centers are the cornerstone of care for all of the people that we're now talking about. And one of the greatest tragedies is that we have a hard time holding on to our staff members for a variety of reasons. And physicians do not find it an attractive place to work for a number of reasons. There are not nearly enough psychiatrists in the area to handle all of the patients who need mental health services. So the majority of those patients will see a family physician first. So what I think that we need to do, and it's a glaring weakness in my mind, is attract more quality family physicians to work at community health centers, which really are the safety net and often the initial place of service for a lot of people that have serious mental health and physical health problems. And that goes back to some extent to medical school training, because this type of work at community health centers is not attractive to medical students. It's poorly reimbursed. I think it's not considered sexy by students in that are studying or want to study medicine. So, if the community health center could continue to have increased funding and increased talent at every level, that would go a long way to helping all of these people get the care that they need.
David, thank you so much for the call. Makes sense to you, Jackie?
Well, certainly. I mean, I know that there is a shortage of mental health professionals that take Medicaid. I mean, we get those calls all the time from people looking for somebody who takes Medicaid. And, we need to incentivize more students to take on psychiatry and to particularly in the youth area, serving children and youth. But the primary care doctors, have been good, I think, in helping people identify initially those problems and helping them get them as treated. But at some point when you're treating serious mental illness, you really do need a psychiatrist.
Dr.
And that speaks again to the workforce pipeline issue. Work that we do through the Area Health Education Center at St. Louis U. It's that idea of recruiting folks to see options in terms of training, attracting students from underserved areas, getting students back there as professionals. So as David, our caller, mentioned, reimbursement and salary is part of the story, but another very important part, since primary care and psychiatry is just a very small part of the wraparound services and the care of folks with mental illness. Mm-hmm. If we look at what social workers, just to pick one area, one profession, what they get paid compared to how much they have to spend for a master's and then a license in clinical social work, it's extraordinary. It's very difficult to make tuition payments for 25 years on a most social worker salary. So we need to look at loan repayment and other incentives to increase the pool of healthcare professionals.
Scholarships with a commitment to work in this field for X amount of time.
Definitely. Or a mix where you could work one or two days a week in the field for 10 or 20 years.
Want to get a couple more calls in here. They look like they'll be interesting. We'll bring in Francie calling from University City. Francie, is this the Francie we know and love?
Well, you know me. I don't know how much you love me.
I wanted
to say you have some wonderful panelists, and I'd like them to speak perhaps about the role of housing in recovery. And I know Dr. Mancini has done research, and specifically I'm wondering if we could have an initiative that the governor could lead with our tax credit program to direct a larger percentage of those low-income housing tax credits towards supported housing, since there's such a need for people with serious mental illness. And I do believe that for very vulnerable people, it really helps them in their recovery. And so I'll take my answer off the air and keep up the good work, you guys.
This would be Francie Broderick. Thanks so much for calling, Francie, and Happy New Year to you. Dr. Mancini, why don't you pick it up?
I think that supported housing is one of the most important programs that we can fund. It's underfunded right now. It needs to be there. because as I mentioned before, when you're talking about outreach to people and trying to bring people into the system, we know that if you receive care for an extended period of time, you get better. And so the challenge is keeping people in the system of mental health care. And oftentimes what they need is, you know, the first question you'll hear is, I need housing. I don't have a place to live. I need quality housing. And sometimes the answer of the mental health system is, well, all we have to offer you are psychiatric beds and medication, and maybe some counseling that you're not really interested in. So we need to fund these programs that provide people with access to housing. And then once people are housed, you're able to work on other issues to help them integrate back into the world. You can provide them with employment skills. You give them stabilization so you can help them achieve other goals that they may have, like reducing their substance use or taking their medications more regularly or learning other kinds of work and social skills. So I think it starts with housing, and it's a vital program that needs to be expanded.
No argument from you, Jackie, nor from you, Dr. Ryan.
Well, you know, I would add that I do agree with Francie that, you know, we need a leader in government, and maybe that's our governor of the state of Missouri, to focus on this issue, because we have never addressed the Olmstead issue in the state of Missouri, particularly for people with mental illness, the way we should have. And there's an awful lot of people with mental illness who are young living in nursing homes who really should not be there. And, you know, that could be a lawsuit waiting to happen. I know it was in the state of Illinois. So, you know, we need to do something. And it would be great if we had leadership, you know, from the governor or some of the mental health or Missouri Housing Development Commission to really take this on.
I have time for one more call, I think. We'll bring in Ellen from North County. Ellen, go ahead, please, but keep in mind that our time's getting away from us.
Okay, I got a classic case. My son has a mental illness, and when he got in trouble at school, they would suspend him, and I would work every day. So he would stay up at night and get in trouble, and then the law was on him. And I never got any sleep, but when I would call out to ask for help, and it wasn't on my insurance, I never got any help. And the Department of Mental Health did send in a crisis intervention to the home, and she just reported to the police. Well, he could no longer live with me when he became an adult. He got violent. He's incarcerated right now, and I don't know what's going on because nobody's telling me anything because he's an adult. But he needs, I like the idea, was that Dr. Radnick had said to give him a place to live and give him an opportunity for employment because he's not a bad person.
Ellen, let me stop you here only because of our time constraints. I think we have the point, and I'll go across the panel, and Doctor, I'll start with you. This is what we're talking about. This
exactly.
is a classic case, I would assume.
Very much so. A person has mental illness. The events of his life cascaded. He's in prison now. Mom's without is at a loss as to how to access services.
30 seconds, Jackie.
You know, I think we need more services like mental health court, you know, that can divert people from going to jail in the first place. CIT is another. We need more of that.
More, money. That's the stumbling block.
Well,
Dr. Mance, go
you
ahead.
Know, we could be a better use of money, you know.
Sure. Let me get a final thought from Dr. Mancini.
I think it's a smarter way. You have to think about smart implementation, and so lifespan development, in-house services for families, and then across the main spectrum of helping people get housing, employment, and mental health court services for people who are older. So lifespan approach.
Well, we thank you so much. Dr. Michael Mancini, Jackie Lukic, and Dr. Fred Rutnick, thank you so much for being with us and helping us bring this issue to the attention of the public. It's an important one, obviously. And hopefully we've made some progress in convincing people they can help and doing something about it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Join Steve Potter tomorrow for Cityscape when he'll talk about the new Louie Awards for Excellence in Local Theater with members of the Dixon String Quartet and about the Low Brass Collective's gala concert. Monday on St. Louis on the Air, the 11 a.m. program will be preempted for coverage of President Obama's inauguration. That's at 10 p.m. I should say at 10 p.m., however, we will revisit our discussion about racial profiling and the police. Archived versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is produced by Mary Edwards and Alex Hoyer, with production assistance from Aaron Dorr, Spencer Reed, and Drew Becker. The executive producer is Robert Peterson. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.